I remember Paul McCartney coming into our dressing room and saying, well, you know, I've got this new song, would you like to hear it? So he played it, and it was Yesterday. He sang it to Scrambled Egg, like Scrambled Egg, you know. It was a great experience. I was actually learning to become an actuary, which they work in life insurance, you know, they're very highly paid. And I think sometimes, oh, I might have had a lot more money than I have now.
Hello and welcome to episode 49 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson. Thanks as always for hitting play. Now, this will be the last interview episode until the new year. I'm taking a little break. I'm going to be back at the end of January after a rest and a chance to get some more big names in the bag. Just like today's guest. We're going out before Christmas with a good one, I tell you. There's going to be some special shows getting released, though, so the classic rock will keep coming your way. Don't worry. But right now, I'd just like to take this moment to say thank you to you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the podcast, engaging on social media, spreading the word, and generally coming along on the ride with me. It can be a lonely thing making a solo podcast, although I do get to speak to some big name guests, of course, which is brilliant. But once it's kind of recorded and published and out there, that's kind of it. It's just out there in the ether. So it is always heartening to get messages or emails from you, which makes it all so much worthwhile. And it really does, I tell you. So thank you very much from me, sincerely, for this last, 14 months we've been doing this. Now, before we hear from today's brilliant guest, let's get to the shout-outs on the show. Hello to Ron Lemons, who was in touch after finding Vintage Rock Pod on YouTube and getting in touch on Facebook. Hello to Andy Old as well. He's been brilliant at sharing Vintage Rock Pod as usual and getting in touch with some great ideas. To Dave Webb as well, who's been in touch, who found the show recently, and to Elijah Groves, who's in touch by email with some very kind words. It was lovely to hear. Thank you very much. Some of the chat on the social channels this week centred on people's favourite Scottish bands, musicians and singers, seeing as though it was St Andrew's Day. Friend of the show, Joseph Kay from Play That Rock and Roll podcast said, there's many good options, but Bon Scott is head and shoulders ahead of almost any rock vocalist. Jokul Borhi and Dan Tomaski both said Nazareth. 80s Rewind again said Simple Minds. And Mikkel Verhus said Runrig. Now, there's a shout for traditional Scottish rock, I tell you. On Instagram, Bella Lugosi said The Vaselines, a band that are pretty much synonymous nowadays with their connection with Nirvana. Kurt Cobain loved them and covered many of their songs famously. And Dassy Girl said Midgeur All Day Long. I love those shouts. So many great acts to come out of Scotland. Personally, I'd say it's between Big Country and Simple Minds for me. But thanks to everyone who joined in this week with the chat and others too. If you haven't already, please do check out the social channels. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod, especially the YouTube channel at the moment where I post videos of the interviews I do, which is pretty cool to see. So without the way, let's crack on with this week's guest, a legendary drummer with a legendary group, one inducted into the Hall of Fame in just the third year of the Rock Hall's existence, entering at the same time as the likes of Johnny Cash, Jimi Hendrix, and Ike and Tina Turner. That's the level that this band are at. I'm talking about the Yardbirds, a band so big in the 60s their guitarists included three bona fide legends, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and Eric Clapton. All three were in the top five of Rolling Stone magazine's Greatest Guitarists of All Time list. Now, today's guest is the only ever-present member of the band. He's been there, seen it, and done it with all of them. Jim McCarty. Now, the Yardbirds straddled so many defining styles of the 60s. Blues, rock, psychedelia. They were early pioneers of what kind of became the sound of heavy metal as well. They were known for what they called their rave-ups, the instrumental breaks in the performances, and the dueling lead guitars as well. It's all kind of brand new. Now, although the band's life was pretty short-lived, and they lasted only about 5 years from 63 to 68, their catalogue and legacy cannot be undermined. So with that background, here it is, my chat with legendary Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, yes, another one on the show, Jim McCarty from the Yardbirds. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by a legendary musician who introduced innovative, groundbreaking styles into the early days of rock and psychedelic music in the 60s. He kept the beat for some very famous hits and some very famous musicians over the years and is now the only ever-present member of the Yardbirds. My pleasure to welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, Mr. Jim McCarty. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you here on the show. Now, as we said there, the Yardbirds, I mean, such a legendary, iconic group, and you were recognised when you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, and that was in the early days of the institution as well, back in 1992, along with Jimi Hendrix Experience, Ike and Tina Turner, Johnny Cash. I mean, absolute legends. So let's start there. I mean, talk to me, Jim, about the Rock Hall, your experience on the day, the event, what it meant to be inducted alongside those luminaries, and looking back and reflecting on it now.
Well, the funny thing was that Johnny Cash was inducted, as you said, and he was one of our idols. You know, when we were at school, we used to have a school band and we used to play Johnny Cash songs. There I was standing on stage right next to him, you know, at the ceremony, which is fantastic. You know, unfortunately, Jimmy it wasn't there, you know, Jimi Hendrix, but it was a great night seeing, you know, so many other people, Carlos Santana and B.B. King and Keith Richards. Yeah, it was great. It was very nice.
And how did it feel being inducted that early into proceedings? Because like we said, it'd only been going a couple of years by that point, hadn't it? And to be recognised so early on that you were such an influential group must have been amazing.
Yes, I'm not sure what the rule is. Is it so many years after you played or something? I don't know what it is. There's some ruling. And we did get put forward the year before, but it didn't happen. So I thought it might be coming, but it's amazing. All of a sudden, you know, you realise what you've done.
Absolutely. So such an iconic group, a legendary band. I mean, but going back before that, I mean, you worked in the stock exchange, didn't you? It wasn't always the rock and roll lifestyle. You worked in the stock exchange and you had to speak to your boss about getting some time off to go away and play with your band, didn't you?
Well, actually, I worked in the stockbrokers, and I spoke to my boss actually about leaving the job. Because I thought, oh, you know, the group's going to carry on, but I said there was one condition, you know, could I come back? You know, up sort of a couple of years time, could I have my job back? And he said, oh yes, of course, you know, but of course that never happened.
Thankfully. Did you ever get in touch and see if the job was still there? I don't know.
No, I didn't. I was actually learning to become an actuary, which they work in life insurance, you know, and they're very highly paid. And I think sometimes, oh, I might have had a lot more money than I have now. but I wouldn't have been in the same life, I must say.
Absolutely. So in the early days, I mean, let's talk about the Crawdaddy Club. I mean, you guys took over from the Rolling Stones, didn't you, with the residency there?
Yes. They used to play every Sunday. And then they got too big. I think they started having a couple of hits and they went off. I think they went off on a nationwide tour, you know, on the cinemas. And they were looking for someone else. And we went to Giorgio Gromowski, who was the promoter of the club. And we said, we got him to come down to one of our rehearsals. Well, he told us later that he was walking up the stairs and he heard us playing. And we were doing one of those rave-ups, you know, one of those build-up things. And he thought, oh, that's unusual. They're sufficiently different from the Stones, you know, so I'll book them.
Fantastic stuff. Now, the band, in the early days, you were together for, what, 5 or 6 years originally? Was it 63 to 68, something like that? But the music that you guys produced during that period was incredible. And I know that you wrote songs as well, didn't you, famously? Shape of Things and Over Under, Sideways Down, among others as well. Now, talk to me about the music process within the group, I mean, among the band, and how you came up to writing these songs.
Well, I think the best lineup of the band creatively was the one in 66, you know, with Jeff Beck and Paul Samuel Smith, and myself, Keith, and Chris, Chris Dreyer. And that was a great chemistry within the band. I'd been to school with Paul, so I knew him very well. We'd been mates for a long time. And, we always had lots of ideas. And, you know, working in that five piece with Jeff as well, you know, it was a great team. And I mean, the evidence is the, you know, Roger the Engineer album, which is, you know, accredited as being, you know, one of the great albums, one of the cult albums, I think, of all time. And I think that's where it all came together. And that was great fun doing that.
Absolutely. And was it a collaborative process then? Obviously, you wrote songs and others wrote songs. Did you kind of bring it to the table and then you kind of you work on it and see where it goes from there?
Yes, it all worked differently. We had a sort of set time, as it was in those days. You know, we had to produce something in a short period of time. And I think we were booked in for a couple of weeks or something. Ridiculous by today's standards. But we started off and we did some stuff that we used to play live. So maybe a third of it was live stuff that we sort of slightly changed for the recording. And then a lot of the other stuff we just came up with in the studio, you know, with all of us together. So it was quite amazing how it happened. And we thought, oh, we'll have a bit of fun because we'd never done an album like that before. You know, every album before was either a live one or a compilation of our hits. So that was good fun.
So talk to me about then what I've heard you call before the transient members, the three guitarists, the famous ones that we all know. Of course, Eric Clapton, you mentioned Jeff Beck already, there's Jimmy Page as well. They're all very different in styles, in working ways as well. I mean, talk to me about each of those and their influences on the group at the time they were there.
Well, yes. I mean, it was a great beginning. Originally, before Eric, there was a guy called Top Topham, who was also from the art school, who was Kingston Art School, who was, you know, very young, and he had to leave because his parents wanted him to study to be an artist, you know, I mean, a painting artist. And so Clapton came in, and he was like a step further on in a way in terms of personality. And he was, very conscientious on what he did. He was very, very keen to play the blues, and he would practice, you know, day after day playing blues solos that he heard and, you know, copy them and starting them and doing his own. And, so it was a good team for a while. And then we wanted to sort of slightly change the blues slightly because we didn't want to just play the same blues we heard. We wanted to make it our own in a way, make it a bit different. That was where I guess the For Your Love came in, because somebody saw us playing actually with the Beatles at their Christmas show in London, and they thought, oh, they had this demo of For Your Love by Graham Gorman, and they thought, oh, this group, you know, because there's a tempo change in the middle of it and they're doing all these sort of things, you know. So so we all listened to it and we all liked it, except Eric. Eric thought it was too far away from the blues to to consider even. And then he also had some other issues with the band, and he didn't really see eye to eye with a lot of the guys. So he moved on, and we got Jeff. But we asked Jimmy Page, first of all, if he would join, because he used to come and see us sometimes. And he always used to like the band. And he said, well, I'm doing a lot of sessions and I'm quite happy doing that. But why don't you try my understudy who does some sessions for me, Jeff Beck? So we tried him, and he was immediately a success. He was different to Eric. He was very sort of rough and ready compared to Eric, very, you know, tailored and everything. and he sort of had this really long hair, and it was covered in sort of grease and oil from one of his cars who had been underneath it, you know, tampering with it. But he was a great player, and he played a variety of styles, and it really suited us, and it suited us for going forward and making those blues covers quite different and then doing our own songs. So he was great. And then finally it all got too much for him. Well, before that, Paul Samuel Smith left because it was quite difficult travelling around. He got quite stressed stressed out. And he left because he wanted to become a producer. And by that time, Jimmy Page was very happy to join the group. So he came in and replaced Paul on bass. And for a while he played bass, and then we thought, this is silly, we'll swap over with Chris. And so Chris went on to bass for Brave, and the played lead for a while, and which was very up and down, but sometimes brilliant and sometimes a bit of a mess, but something to remember anyway. And then in the end, the stress got too much for Jeff, you know, because he was always very, very nervous, very wound up to the guy. And so he left the group, and we were a four piece until the very end.
Absolutely, and incredible names and stories that you're talking about there. I mean, let's talk about going to America, because that wasn't something that people from the UK did in the 60s, and you guys went over there, and in fact, you were probably bigger in America than you were here in the UK.
Yes, I know. With the British invasion, you know, quite a big thing, and I remember talking to a few people, and they said, oh, this is our dream, to get, you know, other people in other bands. And I think they went if they could, and we love the thought of going to America. I mean, all those, you know, cowboy films and all those movies, you know, on the TV, or the sort of James Cagney films and all that stuff, and then all the music, of course, you know, the blues music and the jazz. And of course, as soon as we got there, we went in, we were down the jazz clubs and the blues clubs and seeing whoever we could. It was so exciting for us.
And how different was it from the UK in the 60s? It was a pretty difficult place to be. And then you go across to America and it was the land of milk and honey, as they say, and everything was very different.
Well, yeah, exactly. It was so huge. I mean, I remember we had to go for an interview to get our visa at the American embassy. And in those days, you used to go in to see the actual ambassador. And the ambassador had, you're going here, then you're going there. That's like 5,000 miles, and that's another 1,000. And I thought, oh, my God, where am I going? And everything was so huge, you know, and such a variety within the country.
Absolutely.
But it was a very, very time. I mean, very exciting that we got accepted out there. Playing their music, you know, that's what it was.
And what was it like being part of a British invasion going over? I spoke to a few different people that were around at the time, Colin Blunstone from the Zombies and Kenny Jones and things like that, and they're going across to America. And as you say, you're basically playing their music back to them, but being received as heroes.
Yeah, I know. It's weird because the young white kids, they never got to see the black music. And it's on a different circuit, you know. It's all very, very highly segregated or whatever.
Yeah.
And of course they all loved us because we had, oh, I love your English accent. You know, they thought we were different, and you know, we had a lot of following, you know.
Brilliant. And on Vintage Rock Show, we like to hear some of the funny stories as well. Now, you played in Paris with the Beatles once, didn't you? And ended up breaking Ringo's, was it his snare skin?
Snare drum skin.
Tell us about that one.
Yeah, because we were sharing the back line. We were the only other English band on, and we were playing for them. And they had a lot of French groups playing jazz and stuff, very strange music, you know. And then we were on the bill, very nice to be, and we were sharing their amps and their drum kit, and I was playing away. And of course, they didn't use to mic up the drums in those days. Yeah. It was very, very, very basic. You might have had one mic somewhere or other. And then, you know, because you had to play pretty loud to play along with Jeff and Chris and Paul, you know. We got to the last song, and I looked down, and there was the, I'd gone right through the skin. I thought, oh, no, on the ring, lovely kit, you know, and his lovely original look with kit. And I thought, oh, no, I've done a terrible thing now. I was very embarrassed. But, of course, it was okay in the end. Ringo sort of shook his fist at me in a joke.
Did you get to hang out with the Beatles then? Did you get to spend much time with the guys?
No, not really. We did a little bit because we played in London, I told you before. We played at their Christmas show, and we hung out with them a little bit, but they were, you know, obviously kept to themselves. But I remember Paul McCartney coming into our dressing room and saying, well, you know, I've got this new song. Would you like to hear it? And, oh, okay. And so he played it, and it was Yesterday. He played us Yesterday. He didn't have the lyrics, but he sang it to Scrambled Egg, like Scrambled Egg. You know, it was great. I mean, it was a great experience.
Incredible. Amazing. Yeah, rock and roll history. And then just talking about the end of the Yardbirds then, obviously it evolved again and Jimmy Page took it on to the new Yardbirds, which then quickly became Led Zeppelin, of course. What was your feelings around that time of the group disbanding?
Well, we were quite relieved, particularly kids, Ralph and I. We were very tired, very stressed out, and we've been playing, you know, day after day, really, for a long time. And playing the same sort of songs, playing the same music. And it wasn't really going anywhere at that time for us because the chemistry in the band wasn't quite the same. We really missed, I think, Paul, Samuel Smith and Jeff. We weren't producing any new songs, and we were being produced by Mickey Most, who brought his own songs into the picture, which weren't always that good for us. So it wasn't really going anywhere. So Keith and I said, well, let's do something else. You know, we've sort of done it. And Jimmy and Chris decided to carry on with the band. You know, well, I think Chris fell out afterwards after we'd left. So, and we were quite happy. Keith and I to get out of it, to have a bit of a rest. I mean, looking back on it, we'd had a bit of a long break, it might have worked, but there was a lot of pressure on those days to keep going and be in the public eye.
Absolutely. And you did a lot of touring, didn't you? It was all about touring for the band.
Touring was the name of the game because that was where all the money was. There were no big record sales in those days, not for us anyway. The record royalties were very low and the record companies didn't really back you. So, all the money was on the road. So you played and played and played.
Absolutely. And then in the 90s, you kind of got back together, well, yourself and Chris and Yardbirds came back and you've toured kind of on and off ever since, haven't you, really, to keep the music alive?
Yes, we have. Sometimes I feel, you know, it's a bit odd because it's only me left, or it was only Chris and I left. But at the same time, it's always a very good band. And I think if it's great musicians playing a great repertoire, you know, that's a point to keep going. And so I'm quite happy to do it as long as I'm fit to do it. Well, I try and keep fit, you know. I walk and I play tennis and I've got plenty of fresh air. So.
Brilliant. Keeping yourself going is the main thing. Now,
yeah,
you released your autobiography a couple of years ago, Nobody Told Me. It was loads of great stories in there, some you've shared with us now and an awful lot more, so people can check that out. But you've just released another book, haven't you, maybe a month or so ago now, She Walks in Beauty. Now, tell us about this one, Jim.
Well, I did the autobiography, as you said, and I mean, everything was going fine. It was like a great time to write, and I was very happy with my life. And then all of a sudden, everything changed because my wife got cancer and she passed on, which was last year, which was a great blow for me. and so I tried to pursue various things, various options to find out what had happened to her, you know, because I know some people had seen her, a couple of people saw her, and a couple of people dreamt about her, you know, since she passed on. So I thought, well, she must be around somewhere. And I'd never done anything like that before, but I took up a mediumship course with a woman called Suzanne Geisman, who is a very sort of famous medium in the States. And she at one time was an officer in the US Navy, something quite different. And she lost her daughter in Iraq, who got struck by lightning. And so she decided to become a medium. And so she started a course on Zoom. And I thought, well, I'll look into it. And then I learned various procedures how to contact Lizzie, my wife, and it worked. I mean, there were quite a few results. And there was quite a lot of evidence that's all in the book. So, and so I go back to the, you know, stuff I've had in the past and sort of various paranormal, things that have happened. And so it's quite, I think it's quite interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. It says it's your personal lifelong quest to unravel the mysteries of the life that exists beyond the world in which we live. So definitely very much different to the old rock and roll stories.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm finding out, you know. Everything sort of getting bigger each day in a way.
Brilliant. And it's called, as we said, She Walks in Beauty, and I'm guessing we can get that on Amazon and all that sort of thing, and maybe your website as well, Jim.
Yeah, it's on a publishing called lulu.com, but yeah, you can get it on Amazon. Yes, available.
Good stuff. Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Jim. I wish you best of luck with the book, and hopefully get you out on tour again soon. Keep playing tennis, keep the fitness up, and we'll see you back out on the road.
Okay, thanks a lot, Paul. Cheers.
There you go, the wonderful Jim McCarty, 78 years young. Although not as flamboyant as some of his contemporaries, his drumming style was highly influential. Some of his tempo changes were brand new, and styles he implemented formed the bedrock of rock drumming for years to come. Right now, it's the time of the show to give you my top 5 songs from this week's guest. Now remember, this is my personal choice. I don't claim it to be the definitive list. It's very subjective and hopefully can maybe open the doors for some who may not be overly familiar with the person or the band in question. Now, I'm going to be honest. With this list, it was one of the most difficult for me to put in order. The amount of times I wrote it down and then moved them around was pretty crazy. I'm still not 100% sure I've got it right, but for the purposes of this, I'm just going to go with it. So here we go, my favourite 5 songs from the Yardbirds, according to Vintage Rock Pod. My number 5 comes from the Roger the Engineer album, released in 1966. It has an Eastern feel to it, but a pulsy beat too, which Jim McCarty says was inspired by Bill Haley and the Comets' Rock Around the Clock. It became the group's 5th top 10 single in the UK and peaked at 13 in the US. And number 5 is Over, Under, Sideways, Down. At 4 is a track considered groundbreaking, our first glimpse of the dueling lead guitars of Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. It's a darker number, again upbeat and pulsating though, described in many ways as the prototype to heavy metal. This psychedelic rock also features a certain John Paul Jones, who'd later join Led Zeppelin, of course, on the bass on this track. At number 4 is Happenings 10 Years Time Ago. At number 3 is their first single to break through, hitting number 3 in the UK and 6 in the US. It features an interesting chord progression and catchy refrain throughout, except for the more pop stylings of the tempo change midway. It was also the song that heralded the departure of Eric Clapton from the group. At number 3 is For Your Love.
For your love, I'd give the moon if it were mine to give. For your love, I'd give the stars and the sun for I live.
At 2 is the follow-up single to For Your Love, another big hit this. It featured Jeff Beck for the first time, and he used the fuzz box, which is considered one of the earliest uses of the effect on record, and was the first rock song to really use Indian-inspired sounds ahead of even the Beatles with Norwegian Wood. At number 2 is Heart Full of Soul.
And I know, well, if she had me back again, well, I would never make her sad. I got a heart.
So. And at number one for me is perhaps not an expected pick, but again, it's a song that I love. It's actually a reworking of a song they covered previously, The Train Kept a Rollin', but it just feels a whole lot heavier and darker, and you know I like that. Beck and Page's dual guitars were fantastic. There was the wall of feedback at the start, the heavier chugging guitars. And I also prefer the fuller vocals from Ralph instead of the disconnected double track on The Train Kept a Rollin'. Now, this song was recorded especially for the 1966 movie Blow Up. So, my favourite Yardbird song and the number one song according to Vintage Rock Pod is Stroll On. So there you go, my favourite five songs from The Yardbirds. As ever, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this list. Where do you agree, disagree? Let me know. Drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com. And another request from me to say, please, please, if you haven't already, please do subscribe to the Vintage Rock Pod channel on YouTube. I am trying to push it to 1,000 subscribers that it activates the monetization policy that YouTube has. Until then, any ads that play on the videos, YouTube keep the money, so it'd be nice if I got to have some of that. It is totally free to subscribe. All you gotta do is basically click on a button and that is it. I put up a lot of different content on there, so you can obviously see the videos, you get to see the massive guests I speak to, I throw in some short rock stories, there's a top fives, a couple of quizzes from earlier in the series, other bits and bobs too, so it's well worth subscribing to. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on YouTube and hit the red subscribe button. Obviously check out the social media channels too, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, to keep up to date with all the Vintage Rock Pod action and some classic rock stuff that I post on there as well. Well, there you go. That's it for episode 49 then. Can't believe we've finished 49 episodes, all with huge name guests on every single one. Episode 50 will be with you in the new year, although I'm planning a couple of specials to be released between now and then. Now, if this is your first listen, then make sure to follow or subscribe to the series on whatever podcast platform you use so that you don't miss any of the new ones that drop. And please do check out the back catalogue of incredible big name guests I've had on the show, a whole host of superstars, multi-million sellers, Grammy Award winners, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. There's so much to enjoy, and they all have great rock stories to tell as well, involving some legends of our beloved rock world. Well, that's it for me then. Until the next one, remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.